I'm going to blast through these. As I've mentioned before, the PowerPoints are all posted on BSpace. So you want to go and take a look at these, because obviously, unless you have some IBM rank Xerox photographic memory, you're not going to be able to get all this stuff. Okay. All right, so let's take a look at these goals. Here they were, as you might expect them. They were a bunch of goals pertaining to hunger, universal primary education, gender empowerment, child mortality, maternal health, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. A bunch of, if you like, economic and social and gender and political and environmental goals. That's what they were. And the idea then was that each of these goals, incidentally, and go online and take a look at some of the materials that are on BSpace, each of these goals had sub-goals, if you like, very specific, concrete things about what was to be achieved at the level of hunger by 2015. That's the watershed, okay? So, what's the broad picture then against which those Millennium Development Goals are being assessed? Well, let's start with some obvious numbers, right? And don't be concerned right now with some of the measures that I'm going to be using and some of the concepts. I'm going to come back to it. But let's just start with the obvious fact that was clear in 2000 when the UN set up the Millennium Development Goals, is that there's a crap load of poverty in the world. Right? The World Bank estimates currently that there are 1.4 billion people who live on less than $1.25 per day. That $1.2 per day is an important income poverty measure. It's the standard, actually. Don't forget, here we're talking about multilateral development institutions. The World Bank is arguably the most important multilateral development institution. It does many, many things. It lends money. It funds projects. It conducts research. Right? It produces every year this annual compendium, the World Development Report, etc., etc., etc. It's a center of excellence. They've established this income baseline, this income poverty measure of $1.25 per day. And any person or a proportion of any country that falls below that threshold, ipso facto, is poor. And I was talking about mass poverty. So by definition, then, 20, 30 or more percentage in X country might fall below that threshold. Okay. FAO estimates 1.2 billion are hungry. UNDP. Right, 2005, in effect, this sort of map of poverty globally, a lot of people, right, 25 to 30% who are defined conventionally as poor, as they put it, 40% of the world's population, constitute, in effect, a global underclass. That's their language. Right? These aren't young Marxists or young Trotskyists. This is the UNDP. The UNDP is like the World Bank, the United Nations primary development institution. Multilateral. When I say multilateral, I mean that these institutions are constituted, its members, by governments. Right? UNDP is another, and here they say, faced daily with the reality of threat to extreme poverty. Life expectancy, convergence or divergence? Well, why have I put a question mark there? Well, this is obviously a quite shocking statistic. Burkina Faso in West Africa, the average Burkina Fasan can expect to live 35 fewer years than someone born in Japan. There's a huge discrepancy then between life expectancy. And don't forget, life expectancy is an extraordinarily powerful measure of well-being. Not just of being poor, but of well-being. How long you can expect to live, what your chances are of reaching 40, what your chances are of dying at less than 5 years. That's a bunch of things go into that. How much food, what your income is. It's a whole, this is a very powerful and dense measure. Right? Now, I say convergence or divergence because some people say, well, look, whatever picture you paint, Michael, right now, of the map of global poverty, one thing is relatively incontrovertible, which is the gap between life expectancy, let's call it in the developed world, or the first, call it whatever you wish for now, that there has been a convergence in life expectancy between the developed and developing world. That's to say the gap has been getting narrower, all right? However, I'd immediately want to say that you've got to be careful about those statistics. Because if you look at the period since 1960, let's say, bear in mind a bunch of countries became independent in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, or form, that are now what we call the developing world, right? That since 1960, let's say, right, there has been this convergence. But in fact, most of that convergence occurred in life expectancy, that's to say the life chances of in the developing world improved and became closer to those of the US or Germany or Russia, occurred before 1990. And in fact, the data suggests that since 1990, there actually has been a growing divergence. Okay, so that's not a rosy... More than a billion people lack access to safe water, more than two... Okay, so these are just a... But I'm just painting for you then on the landscape of something called the global economy or the globe, the existence then of mass poverty on a highly significant scale. And again, this was the $125 a day threshold income poverty measure. And this just goes to show, depending on how you cut it, if you were to put it at $10 a day, a whopping $3,600 per year per person, you can see, in fact, that 80% of the population would fall below that threshold. So depending on how you cut it up, it's a lot of people, right? And of course, let me just make the obvious point, and I'm going to come back to this in just a second. These are conventional definitions of the income. There's lots of ways of measuring poverty, right? We're income. We're talking how much dough you have, right? We're saying that that, of course, is defined by these multilateral development institutions. Let me also say, of course, that if you live in Indonesia, Nigeria, or Ecuador, all virtually all countries have their own national income poverty lines. Okay, so, and the two don't necessarily meet. That is why sometimes when you're going to be reading stuff, you're going to see the World Bank says that actually 28% fall below the poverty line in India. India, however, says 17% fall below the poverty line. Why? Because they have different income thresholds and perhaps different ways of actually measuring income. So, why am I raising that? Because you can see immediately that these numbers are, of course, artifacts of human endeavor. There's nothing objective about this 125. I mean, why not pick a dollar? Why not pick a... I mean, who the hell's doing the picking, selecting? Right? And obviously, if you're a national government, imagine what it implies for your political legitimacy if you were to change the income poverty level. You could, overnight, reduce the number of people that are poor by 40% by dicking around with the income level, right? But of course these numbers are political. So what I'm saying then is, I want to start off by saying they're conventional ways of measuring, but of course we've got to figure out who's doing the measuring, that they necessarily are going to be political in some way or another. There was a huge debate in the development constituency which resulted in the poverty income level that the World Bank uses increasing from this to this. It changed in 2008. Huge debate. Obviously, you can see what that does, among other things, right, in terms of the numbers. We can get into why that happened, and I'll talk a little bit about it. But all I want to frame for you now, then, is the issue of conventional measures, income poverty, it's a threshold. How many people fall below that? 1.6 billion? And what proportion of the world or the nation's population fall below that threshold? 20%? 50%? Those are key measures within the Millennium Development Goals of the existence of something called global poverty. All right? Of course, I've said there's a lot of poverty, but by the same token, I think you'd have to say, wouldn't you, that in fact, because I have a type of, it's easy to have a dystopian, what does dystopian mean? I'm going to improve your vocabulary. Dystopian? Sorry, you got to scream, I'm deaf as a post, yes? Opposite of utopia, yeah, so this is like a bleak prognostication. Thank you. Right. So it's easy to be dystopian when you're looking at this bleak vision of 1.6 billion people, you know, a third of humanity falling into this mass category. But on the other hand, it seems to me you'd have to say this without at all being seen to be a type of, you know, Panglossian optimist about it. You'd have to say, on average, this is true. People born in developing countries today can be anticipate being wealthier, health. That is, seems to be true in general. Little more than a decade, life expectancy has increased by 2 years. 2 million fewer deaths. Chance of a child reaching age 5 has increased by 50%. I mean, all of those things, it seems to me, are true, and they're important types of achievements. I mean, they have to be recognized as such. So I'm not here casting this sort of dark, manic, depressive type of vision of the world. But nonetheless, it seems to me in the center of all these statistics exists the 1.6 billion, right, who fall below that poverty line, which is to say, you know, I mean, barely $400 a year. Okay, that's what we're talking about. Okay. To that extent, you know, this is the World Bank trots this out all of the time, which is to say that, again, income poverty, we're only talking about income, it looks like in significant parts of the world there has been a decline. This is the share of people in East Asia, Latin America, falling below that poverty line. In this case, this is actually using the $1 PPP. What does PPP mean? Thank you. What does that mean? Why? Why not just say a dollar? Yeah, right. Without getting into the technicalities of this, although we will a little bit later on, obviously this is comparative data. It's comparing the number of poor people in the Middle East, in Lebanon, versus Sub-Sahara in Nigeria. Well, of course, there are currency fluctuations. What you can buy with a dollar in one place. So it's actually rather tricky to calculate this. And in actual fact, therefore, a bunch of economists try to standardize this in a particular way without getting into too much detail. So all I want to point out then is that given that that type of standardization, dollar a day, you can begin to see that this is comparative. Different proportions of people are poor in different parts of the world, different countries. But the trend here, generally speaking, is in fact downward. Right? And so in a sense then lots of people, up until 2001. That doesn't exclude the fact, obviously, that there are still, right, large, in spite of the fact that, well, this is a slow decline, right? This is a little fat. There are still, there's a geography to this mass poverty. Clearly, some parts of the world, it's, you might say, endemic. It's parts of South Asia, parts of Southeast Asia, much of Sub-Saharan Africa. Conversely, East Asia, you can see there has been a spectacular decline in the share of people. And that's almost wholly accounted for by China. So all I'm trying to say then is these numbers, it seems to me, however, you of course can immediately say, well, yeah, but income isn't everything. I mean, are people getting educated? And what's happened? Of course. But I'm simply saying then that these are the sorts of numbers that get typically trotted out up until 2001. However, after 2001, things begin to change. You'll see in just a second. All right. Well, here's an immediate response to this, right? Here are the poverty levels. They're all downward, right? Now you take out China and look what happens to those levels, right? They look a bit different. So immediately you'd have to say, but wait a second, if you're talking globally, if you're looking at regional trends, an actual fact, the numbers look a little bit different. That doesn't, of course, deny from the extraordinary achievements in China since the late 1970s at the level of that income improvement. But nonetheless, and this casts a rather different shadow, it seems to me, when you view it in this way. And in any case, then it seems to me, even with that income decline, the reason why these Millennium Development Goals were established in the first place is precisely because there have been in some places, in some parts of the world, not just poor performance at the level of income, but catastrophic reversals going the other way. 18 countries with a combined population of 500 million registered lower human development scores in 2010 than in 1990. Right? Human development, I'm going to get into this in just a second. This is part of the things that the Millennium Development Goals measured. Universal primary education, health, and a whole bunch of social measures, right? But they were going backwards. 50 countries with a combined population of 1 billion are going backwards on at least one of these 8 millennium development goals. 65 countries with a population of 1.2 billion will not meet at least one by 2050. Africa will not meet its child mortality target with current rates of improvement until 2115. Right? It's a century and more behind. Our estimates are UNDP again, 2.5 billion, we're living on blah, blah, blah. 41 countries, the gender gap as regards schooling is widening. Right? 41 countries, it says then, that overall adult literacy or universal primary education, the numbers may be improving, but it's in gender terms bifurcated. It's males and male adults who are getting educated and or are signing up for it, etc. UP, universal primary education goals will not be met by 2050, may not be met by 2050, 2 billion plus. Well, so, all of which is to say then, in spite of that, quote, income decline that is much heralded, the reality is that in some parts of the world, there have been these catastrophic reversals, which it seems to me Darwin's Nightmare. Interesting film, isn't it? As a dystopia. This is a bleak vision of the world, right? But one of the things that I can say for this course is that you can't run away from that bleakness, right? What does it mean to be poor and female in Mwanza on the shores of Lake Victoria? You saw these women, right, plodding around in fish entrails. This is not a pretty vision, but this is a reality you can't run away from, and that's part of this mass poverty that has to be addressed. And so I just thought I'd say, well, you know, based in Tanzania, right? This is, Tanzania is a classic case in which mass poverty. Here are some numbers. Per capita income, $400 a year. Life expectancy, 56. Poverty headcount ratio. How many people, what proportion of the population falls below that conventional 125 a day? 35%. Percentage that falls below $2, 83%. Adult literacy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Let me just throw one last thing in. Interestingly, though, this. Right? That's, you know, mass poverty. Poverty is endemic. However, the Gini coefficient. Gini coefficient is a measure of concentration of something. How unequally distributed something is. The Gini coefficient of income distribution, right, in Tanzania is 0.3, which actually, in global terms, is extraordinarily equal. Now, you may say, that ain't much of an achievement when 80% of the population lives. Okay, but inequality is certainly an important issue that we're going to be talking about. What's the Gini coefficient in the U.S.? Well, we know it's one of the most unequal distributions of income, along with U.K., my people, in the advanced capitalist states. Yeah, what is it? Anyone know? Pardon? It's not 0.8. I think the highest Gini coefficient, Namibia, I think it's Namibia, and I think it's 0.7, which is unbelievable. Brazil is usually rolled out, and we'll be talking about Brazil, has an unbelievably unequal income distribution, in spite of the fact, of course, that it's one of the most dynamic economies right now, actually. And it is about 0.67. And the U.S. is not far behind. All right? So, and here's Mwanza, where the movie was. This just shows severity of poverty. I'll come back to what this term means in a second, but I just want to show that Mwanza, the higher the figure, the deeper the severity. Well, let me just say a word about severity. What severity is talking about? You could say, how many people are there that fall between this line? Dollar a day, right? And you could say, oh, 25%, that's a lot of people. But how deep is that poverty? If you are actually earning less than $1.25 a day, you could actually be earning $1.24 a day. Or you could be earning 28 cents a day. How, right? That's the depth of it. That's really, really important, right? Because it actually talks about there's the possibility of, even within the existence of something called mass poverty and a lot of people being poor, there can be some people that are off the bloody map. Is that clear? where the chances of them even getting above that $1.25 a day are grotesquely limited. That's what that is talking about, right? And this is just somebody saying, then there's a lot of that in Wanza, where the film was. If you haven't seen it, take a look at the film. I know you're discussing it this week, so you should have seen it already. I love the Russians, the guys with the, well, the, what's that, what's the, what are those crappy Russian planes? The Sloshkin, Shlutin, oh look, what are they? Ilushkin, Ilushkin 46. This, I love it when they're working on that damn thing and you need parts, pieces of it are falling off. Did you catch that? I mean, it's really, it's quite grotesque. Yeah, but you know, is what's that old? Forgotten. Anyway, it's really interesting movie, because it seems to me it's not just about the existence of poverty in a particular part of the world, but shows an interesting intersection of forces, right? There's a health HIV. There's a poverty livelihood. There's an ecological sustainability. There's a foreign aid. And then there's a sort of gun running. I mean, it's like a perfect storm in a way, right, of a type of developmental conundrum. All right, so that's just to give you some context of that. So again, all I want to point out here, don't, you can look at this at your own leisure, as it were. These are these Millennium Development Goals. I just got three of them here. Here you can see are the sub-goals under eradicating extreme poverty and hunger. You've got reduce extreme poverty by half, productive and decent employment for everyone, and reduce hunger by half. Again, all of these have to be measured in a particular way, right? Like hunger, how do you measure hunger? Calories, what is it, 2,100 kilocalories? Is that what you measure? Right, so all these have to be measured in particular ways. Right, and it just simply says that if you take a look at these in different colors, just highlights the fact that these sub-goals and the goals in general, right, are in fact very unevenly being met. Red means in fact that they're not going to be met, and it could be going in the other direction. The brown means it's possible it's going to be met, but probably not. And green, dark and light, is, yeah, they're going to be met, and we're doing fine. And you can see this by region, right? Africa, Asia, Oceania, etc., etc. It's a very uneven picture. That's to say, then, what we can begin to see when we look at poverty, global poverty, these Millennium Development Goals, the establishment of targets 2015 to be achieved from 2000, it looks like a very mixed bag. Yeah, you just, another way of looking at this. This is purchasing power, et cetera, et cetera. You can see, extreme eradication of poverty and hunger. You can see here that hunger rates are going down in some cases. Sub-Sahara, it's basically static. Here's universal primary education. You can see some interesting up figures, but in other cases, it's slow or stagnant, in some cases coming down. This is the former Soviet Union, incidentally. So again, it's a complicated picture when you begin to look at these Millennium Development Goals. And now if you begin to take them apart, then the picture becomes even more complicated. And I said, well, you know, let's take a look at it from the vantage point of 2010, right? And it's mixed, et cetera, et cetera. Well, here's the latest 2010 Millennium Development Goal report, which I didn't assign you because you already have a lot for last week. But these are some recent numbers, right? And not surprisingly, what this Millennium Development Goals raises is, what the hell happens when you have a global recession? That's what this is saying. Right? It's simply saying, when you have a bunch of incredibly smart Wall Street bankers cooking up financial instruments that are utterly bogus, right, and chopping and dicing mortgages and securitizing them and selling them in utterly disreputable and unethical ways to various people. And once you do that on a large enough scale and give your bank, that can have, we now know, right, enormous consequences. And that can trigger a global recession, where the crisis within finance can drag down others. Okay, of course. Well, the question is then, what they were just raising is, well, actually, the spillover effect on Millennium Development Goals can be profound. Global economic crisis has slowed progress, but it's slowing. Deterioration of the labor market triggered by economic crisis has resulted in a decline in employment. Right? Here are the developing regions down here. Right? Which just simply makes the point then that these achievements or this move toward these goals can be complicated by these types of financial arrangements. As jobs were lost, more workers are being forced into vulnerable unemployment. Right? An increase in unemployment and vulnerable unemployment last year, 2009, as opposed to 2008. Ditto over here. Since the economic crisis, more workers find themselves living in extreme poverty. An increase in the developing world in the numbers, the absolute numbers, living in poverty. Okay? So this is just driving home, then, the point of the extent to which these things can be set back. Hunger resurgent. Hunger resurgent. Hunger may have spiked in 2009, one of the many dire consequences of the global food and financial crisis. Progress to end hunger has been stymied in most regions. Right? Last year, 2009, food prices were at an unprecedentedly high level. Why? Why? Why were they? Why? Yeah, why did they go up? Oil costs, all right. So we had, remember the great oil spike up to 150 a barrel, right? All of which, incidentally, don't let anyone tell you, I work on the oil sector, don't let anyone tell you that oil spike was a result of huge growth of oil demand in particularly South and East Asia. It wasn't. Was there an increased demand? Yes, there was. But primarily, that growth in oil prices was a result of speculation on oil futures by those same financial institutions that back in 2008 realized that they were going down the tubes. Okay? But point being, whether I'm right or wrong, I think I'm right on this one, that oil prices increase, and it's not only transportation costs, but what does most agriculture depend on? Machinery and? Thank you, inorganic fertilizer. Right. Okay, so one. Okay, what else? Yes.
The biofuel.
Excellent. What happened there?
Well,
whether they were stealing it or not, we'll get to that. They actually, interestingly, in some parts of the world, there has been this land grab, which we'll talk about later in the class. But biofuels, largely because there were, among other things, a series of incentives. And with the prospect of $150 a barrel, biofuels suddenly looked like there was the threshold for profitability had been lowered and that they were in business. Yeah, well, there was a global war and or there were a run of bad harvests in 2009. Absolutely. What else? Yeah, you bet, absolutely, right? Food futures, they're speculative too, right? So, okay, so what we're saying here then is it's a complicated set of arguments that produce this, but, right, what that does is set back some of the hunger eradication and or employment, and bear in mind, that can have a huge impact, clearly, in terms of the long-term achievement of these Millennium Development Goals. Yeah, another one here, gender, right? I mean, just makes the point. Hope dims for universal primary education. That's not going to be met by 2015. And then obviously the gender issue here. Poverty is a major barrier to UPE. And just and the point is there's a strong class dimension to this. Look at the differences in terms of the proportion of girls v. boys who are out of school or not being educated by class, right? So all of which is to say then that there's an objective that's not being met, and then there's the fundamentally gendered nature of access to UPE that also is going to radically undermine this particular Millennium Development Goal. Yes, ma'am. No, right. It's a good question. For the most part, don't forget, the answer to your question is the Millennium Development Goals are just interested in whether kids between 5 and 10 or 10 or 5 or whatever are or are not in school. That can be, as of course you'd imagine in most developing countries, are state-funded, publicly funded institutions. They may be, doesn't say how well those institutions are funded, doesn't say whether there are textbooks, doesn't say whether there are teachers there, It just uses data on enrollment, typically provided by the government, to say what proportion of the population are there. They could be public, they could be private, they could be Muslim, they could be madrasas. Right? So that's all that they're concerned with. So again, when it comes back to what the hell is happening in the schools and quality of education, of course, very, very important questions. But we're just talking here about the enrollment. And the enrollment then is obviously highly gendered, and the universal primary education goal is not going to be met. And in some parts of the world, parts of South Asia, parts of Africa, it's not as it going to be not met by 2015, it's not going to be met by 2050 if current trends continue. It will be met by 2075. Okay, so obviously what does that translate? You've got a bunch of MDG shortfalls, right? So this says if you just take income poverty, right, and the goal number one, it says that the goal is probably not going to be met, and you therefore have this 380 million people, as it were, who do not meet or are not part of the goal being met. In exactly the same way, girls not enrolled in school, if the goal isn't met, etc. So this just drives home the point then, of the existence, the necessary, the inevitable fact that these millennium goals, some of them, will have shortfalls, and where those shortfalls happen are very important, and the magnitude of the shortfall is equally important. All of those dimensions round out our picture of poverty from the vantage point of these millennium development goals. And again, take a look at this PowerPoint, take a look at the numbers. Again, I'm not interested in perfect recall, you know, I'm just, take a look at them, right, give you a sense of the order of magnitude that we're talking about here. Okay, here's another tack then. That was the Millennium Development Goals. Here is another United Nations report released just a couple of months ago. And I thought I'd just use that one to say, okay, well, what's, a little bit later, what's their cut from the vantage point of June 2010 on what this big picture of development stroke global poverty looks like. Retooling Global Development. I didn't assign it to you because it's 387 pages. But interestingly, just take a look at this, right? The need to rethink global development. Rethink it. Okay? I mean, again, this is not some Maoist insurgent group we're talking about. This is the bloody United Nations. They say, we need to rethink global. Why? We've got triple crises. Food, financial, climate. New thinking for global solutions. Getting back on track is no option. New thinking needed with a focus on sustainable development. Balance material wealth versus protection of the environment. Ensure social equity and social justice. Main messages, multiple global additional challenges. Okay, so here's again something that, you know, it's really suggesting, in fact, that there are things have happened in the last couple of years that radically don't just highlight the significance of global poverty, don't just highlight the fact that the Millennium Development Goals are probably going to be unevenly achieved, but actually suggest this, that you've got, there's a certain back to the drawing board, okay, back to the drawing board type of, so big and important conclusion. They just point a couple of things here, which I'll just talk about again in terms of, obviously, on the one hand, the black area here. They say, well, of course, we can't run away from the fact it's an important part of the global economy now that China, India, and Brazil, those are usually called the BRIC countries. Brazil, China, India. If you were to include in that Russia, the BRIC countries were the country, you remember Obama flew to Copenhagen. Copenhagen was falling apart. It was clearly going to be a disaster. None of the minimal, the absolute minimal requirements for doing something about climate change was going to happen. It was a total disaster. Right? And Obama needed to recoup something here. So he flew it, remember? Flew in. And who did he see? Did he see the great throng? No. He saw China, India, Brazil, and Russia. Right? Because obviously these are four massive economies. They're growing very quickly. Their carbon emissions are very substantial. And if you could cut a deal with these guys, it might not look so utterly humiliating and such of a failure. Well, he did cut a deal, but we now know that, you know, what was ever agreed there fell apart within 2 months. So it doesn't look so... But anyway, the point being then is that obviously on the one hand, this report is saying, well, there's some good news. Look, China, it's accounting over this period for a growing proportion of global economic output. But then it says, wait a second, it's a bit complicated, because you get complicated patterns of convergence and divergence. You know, these top lines up here, this would be Western Europe and Japan and the United States. They're coming down, right? But they're sort of converging. And then you have a bunch of convergence here, which is really China and Latin America. And then you have a bunch down here going nowhere. And that would be, well, on this map, on this chart at least, India, parts of Central Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa. So you have so it's saying then that you've got to be careful about looking at this and saying, actually, this is the growth and success story, when in actual fact there are complicated patterns of convergence and divergence. Then it says, well, actually, bearing in mind all of this global poverty, let's take a look at and bear in mind those Millennium Development Goals required rich countries ponying up a lot of dough. Some as foreign aid. Of course, the governments of Rwanda and Burundi and Ecuador, they have to pony up stuff too. But those Millennium Development Goals rested on big commitments that were made in the UN in 2000, most of which, incidentally, were not met. That's one of the reasons why some of these things are not going to be achieved. And all this was saying was, look, if you take a look at foreign aid, bear in mind what's the UN recommended contribution by developed countries as a proportion of its total economic output. Anyone know the figure for foreign aid recommended? 0.75%. Other than those bloody Scandinavians, no one meets that. And the United States is currently about 0.1819. All this points out is, look, over time, there's been a huge decline in foreign aid. And interestingly enough, the report says transfers are flowing back after. What are these flows? These flows are looking at capital inflow to the developing world versus capital outflow, right? Financial transfers. So that's primarily, that's not productive, that's primarily banking, whether it's private banks or public banks or foreign aid. And what it's saying is that, see, there's been a flow increasingly back from the developing to the developed world. That's primarily wrapped up with indebtedness and a whole bunch of things. So it's simply pointing a picture here then is declining foreign assistance wrapped up with the Millennium Development Goals and a pattern now of reverse transfer from a period in which flows were in to flows that are now in net terms out. Yeah, okay. All right, so that's the picture then, right? From the vantage point of the Millennium Development Goals. I've tried to give you a sense then of how this Millennium Development Goals represented, in a sense you might say, global poverty becoming a really big political issue. That's why I incidentally mentioned last time, you know, the Bill Gateses of the world and the George Soroses of the world, et cetera, are part of that. And, you know, I made a snotty remark against Bono and U2 and all of that, but to his credit, the guy is quite extraordinary, right? And he's very much wrapped up with, you know, saying, well, wait a second, guys, you've got to do something about this if these Millennium Development Goals are going to go anywhere. Okay? So, on the one hand, then I'm painting a picture here of this global poverty emerges as a really big political issue, as a multilateral issue, and that these goals were set, and we can actually learn a lot about what's happening to mass poverty and where it's happening by looking at the patterns of whether they will or will not be achieved. And in so doing, you learn a little bit, of course, about how a big initiative like this are thinking about something called poverty or development. Those goals, if you like, are defining, they're measuring, they're classifying a whole bunch of things that enter into what it means to be poor or what it means to be developed. Okay? Yeah.
A lot of these things depend on measurement and how accurate.
Totally. What a great question. Great question. All of this. Your question was, we're talking numbers, measurements, statistics. And one of the things I wanted to do in this class today, and opening up in this way, is to, and I'll make the point now since you made it very well, is of course you immediately enter into the world of statistics, of numbers, of measures, of classifying things, of ranking things. Right? And that's not a big surprise. It's a realm, it's not just about measures, it's about a whole series of questions then of who defines the measures. Why are some measures more important than others? Who are the institutions that collect the data? You mentioned governments, also the World Bank, also the UNDP, lots of. So what we've done is to open up that whole arena that you all have to get into in some way, because you're going to be inundated with these numbers, trying to make sense of them. And our friend here, your name?
Dominique
makes a very interesting question, saying, well, to make sense of them, I need to know who's collecting them and whether I could believe shit about these numbers. I've just been giving you these things as though they're cast in stone, right? Well, where does the Millennium Development Goals get its numbers from? I'm going to come back to that in just a second, but what I want to raise is two big issues. When you enter that world of expert development, institutions, numbers, measures, concepts, and you are, as I mentioned last time, entering into the world of epistemology, the way in which knowledge is organized. So when we say, then, your question, where do these numbers come from? You immediately want to be sensitive by saying, but, okay, well, what is this measure actually measuring? Where do the numbers come from? Can we believe them? Right? Why is that measure used and more important than this measure? We're into immediately all of that stuff about how numbers and concepts and meanings and measures around something called being poor or being developed are assembled. And it's very complicated. So let me just give you a 30-second respond to your question about the government numbers. Okay? Where do many numbers come from? They come from censuses. Right? Every country. Is there a country that doesn't have a census? Well, the answer is yes. Many don't. But let me just give you an example. To the extent that some information, let's say on demographic data, how old you are, where you were born, what family, how many members in your family, all of that, that's a census, right? We do it every 10, big deal, every 10 years here, right? Incidentally, that's a political issue in the United States, right? The Republicans and Democrats were actually fighting out over the nature of the census and whether if you're doing a sample of certain sorts of questions, how large that sample should be. The Republicans didn't really want to document lots of people that it conceivably felt were potential demo voters, like, let's say, the Hispanic community. Right? And so immediately, incidentally, census become political. And of course, you could say immediately, well, I mean, what are they collecting numbers for? They're collecting numbers for specific sorts of purposes. Maybe redistricting, maybe the number of senators or congressmen you have represented by your state, local area, whatever it may be. So all this information, you could say a census almost by definition, is going to be a very contested anywhere. Well, the data point that I was going to give you is, I happen to work in Nigeria, in West Africa. The last census in Nigeria that was released publicly was 1966. Forgive me for being vulgar. How the fuck do you know, therefore, how many people there are in Nigeria? I mean, but go to the World Bank, go into the UNDP, go into all of these social measures of indices. You will see there will be numbers there. 43% actually fall below the poverty line. So what I'm saying then is that I don't want to conclude from that we can't say anything of empirically about who's... I'm simply saying that these numbers themselves are going to be very uneven. They are going to be necessarily political things. Why hasn't Nigeria released those censuses? Because Nigeria is a multi-ethnic society. It has, by some estimations, 250 types of... Well, that's 275 or thereabouts language groups. And the point being is that in that context of that of ethnicity and very different politics associated with ethnicity, then how many people there are in the Muslim North versus how many people there are in the Christian South has big political implications for political representation, of course. So they've always been, therefore, incredibly fraught things. So I give you that as just one little indication then that when we start stepping back a little bit and say, well, one of the things you have to be sensitive to epistemologically is where do these numbers come from, who collects them, how much belief, veracity do we have in these? Why does this measure seem to be more important than that one? That's the stuff that I want to alert you to, because it's not self-evident. course. Well, question, what about Somalia? I mean, is Somalia a state? No. I mean, this, what's a state? I'm a modern nation state, right? It has to have boundaries, doesn't it? It has to have a chunk of real estate. And you have to have some set of institutions. Ideally, we like them to be democratic and transparent and accountable. And they can exercise some authority over that territory. They can police the... Right? That's what we're looking... Somalia? Well, first, the northern Somalia is already seceded. Puntland. There you go. I mean, and what is the... Well, like, three ministers were whacked last week. Right? Guy shows up, the Shabab... walks into a hotel where they're having... I mean, what type of government? What form of rule? What are they? What do we know about? Well, go on the World Bank site. The World Bank will tell you that by its estimation, 87% of the Somali economy is informal. Well, that means that they have no fucking idea of what's happening. And maybe not a lot is happening. Who knows? In Mogadishu, it's not. So, you're right. So, obviously, what you've raised an interesting category. State failure. We could call them weak states. We could call them states that are authoritarian. We could call them military hunters. We could call them incapacitated. Whatever language we use, depending on the degree of that incapacitation, failure, etc., it may be that the data itself is almost non-existent. Yet alone those countries that may be functioning democracies, but frankly, running a census is bloody expensive. Right? So either way, all I'm trying to alert you to then is we've got to be careful when we open up that epistemological box about where these numbers are coming from. Right? Okay. So that's the first part. Yeah. All right. Paul Collier, bottom billion. Let me just walk you through his line. He comes at it from a different angle, right? And I think he has some interesting things to say. What is the verse? Firstly, he says, look, I want to start from the fact that there are a bunch of countries, roughly a billion people, life expectancy is less than 50 years, child mortalities are incredibly high, blah, 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 blah. He says, in other words, they are, in a way then, the poorest of the poor, what the World Bank typically refers to as the absolutely poor. Technical term, I'll talk a little bit more about it. Then he goes on to say, look, it's interesting. If you take a look at those 58 countries, right, what you've been finding is, in fact, that they have been underperforming. And if you take a look at, in fact, if you compare those countries and whether they are or not growing economically, if you measure their economic output, that's usually the gross domestic product or the gross national product. I'll talk about these in just a second. But let's just say it's a measure of economic... If you look at how it's performing, look, they were in negative numbers in the 80s and 90s. Conversely, the middle 4 billion were growing very... So in other words, that's a forcing house for inequality, right? These guys are growing, right? And these guys are going nowhere. The bottom billion are poorer than they had been in 1970. My God, can you believe that? That's in some cases no more than 10 years out of colonialism in parts of Africa and parts of Southeast Asia. And they're poorer. I mean, this is a bleak vision, no? And again, this is a guy, World Bank, professor of economics, is simply trying to identify then, when we think about global poverty, a section of the global poor that, in a sense, are almost off the map. All right? Is that clear? So, that's one thing then. And that produces then this divergence, right? Divergence between the bottom billion and the rest of the developing world. So, in other words, what is central, obviously, to this analysis is A, the existence of, let's call it, a fourth world. Right? Now, sometimes there used to be three worlds, I guess, in the good old days. You know, you had the advanced capitalist states. You had the former communist socialist bloc, and then you had the third world. The communist bloc was the second world, third world. I mean, obviously, with the collapse of communism / socialism, more or less, I mean, that conundrum has broken down, or that classification has broken down. But nonetheless, if we call it a fourth world, in a sense, that refers to the fact that there, even within the existence of a class, a global underclass, there's a section of them that are, in a sense, even more excluded, the poorest of the poor, the absolutely poor. That's what the bottom billion is talking about. And I use the language of the fourth world. That comes from a guy called, who used to be here, of course. And then he was bought off by USC. Can you believe it? I know. I mean, you got to have standards, right, is what I figure. Fourth world, Manuel Castells, a brilliant sociologist. He was here for a number of years. I used to go watch Manuel. I used to sit in on his freshman classes just like this. Because he's a Catalan, spellbinding lecturer. Incredibly brilliant man. Strikingly handsome, sure, strikingly handsome. And he always wore these, well, white shirt and like an Armani black suit, Italian wool pants, you know, really well turned out. And he used to do this, if I may. He'd come in, very dapper. And he wouldn't do like, you can see what I do. I wave my hands around and gesticulate and sort of run around. No. And well, we'll come in and he'd do this. He'd say, I'd like to address you, in this Catalan accent, which I can't do. I'd like to address you today about Russia. I'm going to talk about the conditions in Russia. There'd be a long silence. And then he'd say, when I was last talking to Mr. Gorbachev and Mr. Yeah, you know what I mean? It's like most of us here, we're schlepping around, right? But no, with Manuel's, when I was last, I had lunch with Mr. Putin last week, you know? And he wasn't bullshitting, he wasn't blowing it out of his ass. I mean, it's absolutely true. And I guess I'd be very interested in knowing what Mr. Putin had to say about the world. Anyway, be that as it may. Manuel Castells, why am I telling you this? Fourth world. That's the category that he was trying to identify as being, in a sense, the real casualties of a process of globalization and global growth. And that's, in a sense, then, what Collier was talking about. Now, Collier has an account of that. And I want to leave you and walk it through very quickly. He has, not only does he then, he's identified a class of the global poor, the Glendra, right? There's a lot of them, and in a sense, they're part of an increasing global inequality, a divergence that's quite radical that represents an exclusion. And he says that he thinks that that bottom billion are the products of what he calls four development traps. I mean, a trap is something that you conceivably you stumble into, right? It's a situation, it's a circumstance, a set of forces that you could stumble into, and if it's a trap, the chances are you might not be able to get out. So he's thinking metaphorically then about what is it that characterizes this bottom billion and their circumstances as being the poorest of the poor, the bottom billion. And he has four of them. One is a conflict trap. Now this is really very interesting. Somebody says, look, 73% of the bottom billion in or have been through civil war. That's really an interesting observation. Right? In a sense, then, he's saying, well, obviously, civil wars, and incidentally, he's talking about civil wars. And that, in a sense, underestimates the significance of what he's talking about here. He's raising a political variable with respect to development. Conflict. Civil conflict and civil wars. Now, he is not including here what we might call insurgencies. Right? I mean, is there a civil war in Iraq right now? I don't think so. But it's certainly an insurgency. Ditto Afghanistan. Ditto Nigeria. Ditto Pakistan. He's not even including those. Right? So in a sense, the larger landscape, and if you go onto that if you take a look at that United Nations Development Report that I have on B-Space, they have numbers there of political refugees and displaced people, which are the casualties of all of this stuff. And according to their estimate for 2009, there are about 30 million of them. So what Collier is raising then, it's an interesting phenomenon. He's saying that one of these traps is that seemingly endemic conflict has been central to this bottom billion, that the costs of civil war in terms of poverty, slow growth, dependence is huge. If you fall into a civil war, the average length is 7 years. Angola is 28, etc. Right? And secondly, he said the probability if you fall into a civil war, even if you have a truce, some type of mediated conflict, the probability of falling back into it, recidivism, is high. And the cost, the average cost of a war, civil war, is $64 billion. Right? That is far in excess of the total output of the vast majority of sub-Saharan Africa. Right, so first question then is, he's raising a political and conflictual aspect of the developmental conundrum that turns on why people are poor. Okay, second, the natural resource trap. Again, I'm going to talk about this later, so I don't want to go into it much. But he says, look, you know what the other thing is about these countries, these 58 countries that are poor? Is that many of them are one-horse towns. What does it mean? He says the economy is wrapped up with a very limited number of resources that it typically exports onto the world market. Could be oil, could be, if it's Congo, it's coltan, whatever, diamonds, coffee, you name it. And he makes the point then that this resource dependency, right, produces itself a whole series of problems. And I'm not going to go into it right now, except to simply say the following. That what that turns on is also a bunch of politics. He says that in these resource-dependent states, it's often the case that the government, the state itself, captures the benefits of these resources in various ways. And what that means is that because the state is sitting on then a bunch of revenues that come from coffee or gold or diamonds or oil or whatever it may be, that produces then what he calls rent-seeking or patronage. It doesn't produce an open democratic government. It produces lots of corruption with people, different political constituencies, fighting over access to that dough. Okay, so, second trap then, an interesting one, is he's talking about the political economy of let me just say, you may consider he's right, you may consider he's wrong. I'm just flagging for you here a particular account of global poverty that turns on a particular section of the global poor and what he sees as the extent to which their developmental conditions are wrapped up with violent conflicts, resource dependency, landlocked states. Some of you may have read that absolutely mad piece by Ricardo Hausmann that I assigned. If you haven't taken a look at it, I mean, I asked you at the beginning of this class to say, well, why do you think, or if you had to pose the question, why do you think poor countries are poor? Right, well, I mean, one of the compelling, or not so compelling reasons that you often hear is that they got a bad piece of real estate. Bad latitude, right? One iteration of which is, in fact, landlocked. You know, if you're Zimbabwe, you know, you're in the middle of Africa and you're dependent often to ship stuff on neighbors, and they may be hostile neighbors, they may be nice neighbors. But all of this then is a type of 30% of Africa in landlocked states. Okay. So it's a bunch of geographical features, if you like, of the developmental condition. And the last, and we're back to our failed state question, is what he calls bad governance. Right? Poor governance, poor economic policies, cost of failure over poor, blah, 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 blah. Now, I don't just want to leave it there and simply say these four reasons then are an interesting type of account, you know, of a particular subset of the global poor. And we can explore, and we will explore some of Collier's ideas, but it's interesting in a way then that he takes some measures of being poor, and then, in fact, begins to frame them in relationship to a set of conditions that he sees endemic or peculiar to these countries. Violence, natural resource dependency, poor governance, and, if you like, geography. Now, what is central to, of course, the very idea of the bottom billion is, in fact, inequality. Obviously, that is central to the discussion of poverty in general, but in a way, then, the bottom billion is flagging the fact that we are dealing with a hugely unequal distribution of global income. And this is just taken out of the United Nations and just makes the point, right, that, in fact, there's a it's a hugely unequal, that mass poverty is part of a hugely unequal distribution of global income. And that figure on the left there makes the point very dramatically, and this just gives you some sense then of the geographical distribution of this, right? Which is to say then that right here, the poorest are accounted for by these countries down here, for example, so it has a geographical distribution. But the point that I want to mention or emphasize is it's the fact that the bottom million is an index of astonishing global inequality. So this is in a sense the conundrum. Economies may be growing. Human development gaps may be shrinking in some areas and some others, but economic inequalities are widening. So that's, in a sense, the framing that Collier suggests. It's not just about poor, not just about a lot of them, not just about development goals not being met. It's about a highly globalized and increasingly globally inequal distribution. And at the heart is a paradox. The paradox is that, in fact, there may be economic growth, there may be human or social achievement, and yet inequalities are widening. And again, we could go through a bunch of these. You've seen these figures before, but it drives home the point, right? I asked you who was the GDP per capita, number one, the ranking. GDP per capita is Luxembourg, 79 grand. Lowest is number 179 is Congo, 298. That's the nature of the inequity. Of global GDP, of global economic output, only 20% is in the developing world, which accounts for 85% of the world's population. The poorest 20% of the globe's population saw its share of global income decline. The poorest 20% saw its share decline over 30 years. The gap in per capita income between industrial and developing increased 4 times. It's not just global inequality. It's actually increasing. The Gini coefficient of global income distribution between 1960 and it's still increasing. Right? That's the conundrum. In 1980, the average American was 38 times richer than the average Tanzanian. Today, the figure is 61 times. Okay, that just gives you some figures on Brazil and so on. The income Gini coefficient for the world is 0.67. Has been increasing since the 60s. Absolute income inequalities are increasing even when countries have higher growth rates. The world's 500 richest people have income equivalent to the 500 million poorest people. This is a pretty astonishing statistic, isn't it? If high-income countries were to stop growing today and Africa were to continue growing at its current rate, it would catch up in 2236. So when we talk, in a sense, this is what Collier, he may have a completely different interpretation than you or I are going to give it, but what he's opened up with the bottom billion is a picture of globalization and inequality and the paradox of possible economic growth, possible social achievement with radical global income inequality. That's what he's opened up, right? They're pretty astonishing numbers. Yeah, this just makes the point, this is from the United Nations Development Report, that these are just human development reversals, right? This is just, and obviously what we're flagging here, a part of this inequality story, is not just rich and poor, is that under some circumstances, the measures of social achievement, for example, health, education, welfare, etc., may actually be declining quite dramatically, as these figures obviously show. And that inequality, of course, is not only global, but obviously there is the question of the extent to which there's a relationship between growing global inequality and income distribution within countries. And this just makes the point that if you take a look then at income distribution, or in this case the Human Development Index, that Human Development Index is a composite index of life expectancy, education, and income. It's a composite index, right? You can see that by those measures, there are some huge gaps. Ethiopia, India, Nicaragua, Brazil have huge internal, that is to say, high internal Gini coefficients in terms of human achievement. So the inequality issue then is absolutely, absolutely central. So what would I conclude then from this little excursus on Collier and the Millennium Development Goals? Okay, one, world of numbers, indices, you've got to enter into that world, and you've got to be skeptical about them, right? That was the question, it seems to me, about government, right? You're going to be bombarded, inundated with a whole series of indices, measures, forms of classifying, forms of ranking into a world of, if you like, what I call epistemology, and you've got to be careful about it. Secondly, you're into a world, obviously, as I've hopefully exposed, a world of expertise. And that's related to the third point of institutions, actors, and agents. Right? There's a world of development experts. They may be economists. They may be sociologists. They may be policy wonks. You have a bunch of institutions. They may be multilateral. The World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the United Nations Development Program, the World Health Organization. They may be national, the Indian Ministry of Rural Development. They may be non-government organizations, Oxfam, CARE, Food First, whatever they may be. So you necessarily then enter into a relationship between, if you like, on the one hand, number one, forms of knowledge. And secondly, institutions that are in the business of producing and using that knowledge. Right? And obviously then what I'm saying is you've got to be careful about the relationship between the two, and you've got to have a skeptical ability to read them. Then, of course, we're into a world of theory and concepts. Right? That all of these numbers typically get deployed to explain things in a particular type of way. We're into a world of political economy. Right? And what's political economy? Well, the question was censuses. Well, a census is, if you like, an important instrument of modern nation states. Right? Virtually all emerging and modern nation states are in the business of creating censuses. Why? Because they want to know how many people they have. Why? Because they want to tax them. Right? They want to know how many's there. They want to know who's rich, who's poor. Right? They want to inventory who's there. The census becomes a form of ruling. Right? But of course, I've given you enough indication to say that precisely because they're a form of rule, they're also very political. And they can be subject to all manner of occlusions and all manner of biases and all manner of silences and absences. That's the world of political economy. And last but not least, then, we're into a world of meanings and keywords. Right? And quite clearly then, and I'll end with this point, this is key, this is what I'm going to get to next time, and it's what the key reading for this week really addresses. It's one thing to measure poverty in a particular way. Let's call it a poverty threshold, a dollar a day, how many people fall below 35%, that's called the headcount index, that becomes a measure of absolute poverty, etc. Okay, it's one thing to do that measurement, right? However, it's quite another to use that index as a measure of something else. In other words, what do the measures measure? Well, that's relevant because, obviously, you can see just from what I've said today, there's a whole panoply of indices and measures that we could talk about. And if you, for example, want to take a key concept like development and what the hell it means, or what it means to be poor, and you say that my measure of it is going to be income, or my measure of the economy and of development is economic output or economic growth, then by definition, you are investing meaning into the word development and poverty. If on the other hand, you say, actually, no, I think poverty should be defined in terms of well-being and social security. Or actually, I actually define poverty in terms of the extent to which you are or are not free. Or I define development not in terms of economic output or economic growth or income, GDP per capita, but actually I define development much more in terms of a series of social achievements. Well, obviously, then what you're doing is you're giving particular meanings taken from these indices and measures to a keyword. That's what I'm going to leave you with. Very famous, actually a literary critic called Raymond Williams wrote a book called Keywords. And he said, you know what? If you look at the English language, it's a wonderful thing. Most interesting language in the world, he said. And he said, but however, there's some words that are so complicated. Their meanings are so difficult to decipher. And their meanings have changed over time. And he said, I'm going to call them keywords. He says, think of the word culture. Think of the word nature. If you say something is natural, it's natural for you to do this. I mean, that's an enormously powerful word. What is natural? Do you mean genetic? Do you mean it's a disposition you have? You mean it's rooted in bio? What it means to call something natural is complicated and it shifted over time. And what I want to leave you with is exactly the same thing. I've started with two keywords in this class, poverty and development. And those are key words too. And they are also, you can see from what I've said today, enormously complicated in terms of their meanings, how they're measured, how they're used, how they're deployed. And so how you go from these measures to particular meanings of key words is very important. Because if at the end of the day, what development is about is increasing economic output and be damned to everything else, then you've defined development in a particular way. If you defined it as well-being or social security or freedom, you've defined it in a completely different way. And it's precisely that issue of then of the meanings of development and poverty that I'll come back to next time. All right, thank you.